criminal has to be punished.
Exactly.
For the damage they have done to other innocent human beings. Okay?
And Imam Khomeini
now,
is uncompromising
now,
in that.
Now, imagine saying this, and you have a lot of people around you being like, well, no, this
well,
is...
Yeah.
Well, you know... Mm-hmm. Right?
Right.
And, of course, this is going to repel people. Of course, this is going to make some people feel like, you know, why? Let's just kick him out of the country, whatever. Okay? Which is what they were talking about. Okay?
Yeah, sure.
So, the point is that you have this unjust, unfair, imposed war.
Sure.
And it's not just Saddam. It's like Saddam attack. Well, Saddam was the instrument with which all these nations united
attacked.
to kill the Islamic Revolution.
Yes. And this was unprecedented because, as you and I know at the time, the Soviet Union
and the Americans
were at first, you know, they had common ground all of a sudden.
Right. They had the same language.
They had the same language.
Just like Israel and
Saudi
Arabia
have the same language
now.
They had the same language at the time to get rid of Imam Khomeini out of Iran. So
not only Imam, to get rid of the Islamic Revolution.
Revolution.
Because all their battle, all their unjust and evil schemes and plans and profits that they were making and domination that they had, especially in this strategically important area of the Middle East, West Asia, was being threatened.
Sure.
Okay? Mm-hmm. So, the point is that that's when you see this hardcore personality coming through.
Sure.
Okay? Mm-hmm. You have a hardcore personality like him. You have this personality who is not simply trying to, compromise with an evil criminal, mind in terms of, or an actor like Saddam or his supporters or the Zionists or whoever it is.
True.
Even though a lot of people are saying, there was that famous thing during the war, a lot of people who know the history of the war, where you had the president who was then, who then fled in wearing women's clothes, Benisad.
Right.
He basically said, we have to have a strategy where we give territory and we win time.
Uh-huh.
Which, militarily is just...
It's ridiculous.
Ridiculous.
Yes.
Because the whole point is territory.
Yes.
The point is to get back territory in the shortest
possible time.
Right. So a complete, whatever you want to call it, amateur when it comes to military affairs.
Sure.
And, whatever. So Imam at that time is completely standing against that person who, and then, that was the conflict that they got into because he was saying, oh, I have the people's votes and you don't need to tell me what to do. I know what to do, blah, blah, blah. In the end, Imam's like, you know what? You're not worthy of the presidency.
Yes.
And the parliament, impeached
him.
Impeached him.
Oh, impeached him. Yeah. Right.
And he then he went into the arms of the Munafiqeen, of the terrorist cult.
Yes.
Around, those... That,
so
that
he
lady
was
and
really
that gentleman.
Exposed for what he was.
Right. Mm-hmm. And in the end, he ended up shaving his ridiculous little mustache.
Yes.
Putting on women's clothing and fleeing to Paris.
Oh, right.
Right?
Sure.
So this is the deal. Mm-hmm. And basically what you see is that Imam, from the very beginning of the war, is taking a very hardcore strategic view of this.
Right.
He's not only looking at the daily battles and, this kind of short-term, well, let's see what we can do here, then let's see what happens afterwards.
Yeah.
He knows from the very beginning how this thing is going to have to end up.
Sure.
Strategically, historically.
Yes. Sure.
Okay?
Yes.
So, forget about those things that are happening internally. You have insurgency being started in Kurdistan by Saddam.
Mm-hmm.
This is before the
war actually started.
It's actually 2 years before that, where you have Sheikh Chamran going in and the local people joining together with the Revolutionary Guard and, defeating the Saddam-backed Kurdish terrorists. You have the military coups that are being attempted in Iran.
Yes.
The Nojeh coup, where you have former officers being paid by the Americans to, conduct a coup. You have, disturbances in different parts of the country.
Of course.
So there's a million things going on.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have the war. And here's an 80-year-old man, and he's managing it.
Yes, he's managing it.
right?
This is what you call faith and trust in God.
Right. And he's managing it not in the sense of, you know,
yeah, yeah.
Saddam, well, I will, if you don't do this, I'll chop your head off.
No, no. I mean, it's not like he's got detailed plans and charts all in front of him. He's a man who's...
He's managing it based on certain principles.
Principles.
Because he knows that these principles, which are from God...
God.
...will get you the result.
The result.
The most important being that you, as a leader, are not scared, do not have fear, okay. You trust Allah's, you know, power. Over everything else. Mm-hmm. And you don't consider yourself anything
exactly.
in the face of God.
Exactly.
And he has that famous line, I will never forget that line, mm-hmm. where, you know, the soldiers are there in Jamaran, you know those films, which
yes,
is
yes.
like just amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, the soldiers are coming to see him before they go to the front
sure.
in Jamaran.
Yes.
And he's holding a speech. Mm-hmm. And you know those Imam
yeah.
speeches.
It's, fine,
it's
yes.
like, yeah. And he says to them, he says, you're not my soldiers. Because I think they were chanting something, oh, we are your soldiers, or something like that.
No, he said, you're
he
not,
said,
my,
you're not my soldiers,
soldiers
and I'm not your soldier. We are all God's soldiers.
Soldiers. And you do not belong to your parents, you belong to the Imam.
Okay, so this is the things that... This is the kind of leadership you require in these times, okay?
Yes.
There's many examples. Mm. You know, they attack... There's problems. He gets rid of them. Because remember, the president is the commander-in-chief.
Chief.
So he gets rid of the commander-in-chief. He says, you're no good for this.
No.
Okay?
Yeah.
He insists on the Revolutionary Guards being established
sure.
as a revolutionary military force.
Sure.
He insists on the besieged force being established. And he says, we need an army of 20 million.
That's right. Yes,
okay.
Where have you reminded me? Yes,
he says we
right.
need an army of
20 million. Yes, and there was that famous poster with one guy holding up that banner of La ilaha illallah, and you have all these multitudes behind him.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he doesn't dissolve the army.
No. He actually wants to.
Listen, this is a big move
yeah,
by
yeah.
Imam. It's
yeah.
it's a super hardcore, you know,
yeah.
move.
Move.
Because all these left-wing, you know, munafiqeen, all these, you know, radical groups
they
are
want
saying,
to disband the army.
Let's get rid of the Shah's army. This is the
that.
Shah's army. Mm. We will be the army.
Yeah.
And Imam's like, no, these are good guys.
These are good guys.
These guys, it's not their fault.
No.
They were in the army. They were serving their nation. They were defending their country.
Country.
Honorable men.
Yeah.
Most of them religious in their private lives.
Sure.
You know. We have to keep them. Not only do we have to keep them, we honor them.
Honor them.
They themselves know what to do. They don't need American advisors.
Yes.
They know themselves what they have to do.
Do.
They are better than the American advisors. They know how to defend their country better than foreigners.
Yes.
So he keeps the army. He establishes the Revolutionary Guard. He establishes
Besiege.
He gets rid of the...
yeah.
He gets... I mean, that getting rid of Bani Sa'd was just brilliant.
Brilliant.
You know?
Yes, it was.
He's like, dude, you're out of here. Okay?
Yeah.
Mm. He's dealing with the coups. He's dealing with insurrections. Okay.
Yeah. And the other fact that, of course, you know, right at the outset as well, that many of those who masterminded the revolution as well, who later on became the government, they were assassinated by those very...
Exactly. We had the big...
And the Americans were thinking, yeah, we're onto the big one here because...
Remember,
about 72
this is actually,
of them,
you reminded me
yeah.
of a very important
yeah.
episode.
Yeah.
All of this, we're telling these episodes and these... So people know the history.
Yeah.
So they understand the personality of this person. You know,
sure.
you have this thing of Imam and, you know, in the West especially, people don't know his real personality.
No.
So the first person that they kill after the revolution is who? Is Shahid Mutari.
Shahid Mutari, yes.
God bless his great soul.
So, yes.
Okay? The first person they kill is Shahid Mutari, who's one of the leaders, the clerical leaders, who's a smart person.
Yes.
There's a famous story where you have the leaders of the Munafiqeen cult coming to... see Imam.
Yes.
And they have a camera with them.
Mm.
And it's clear what they want is they want to take a picture with Imam and then go around the world saying, oh, Imam has given us the approval that he's with us.
Sure.
And Imam, since before the revolution, had declared them to be non-Muslims.
Yes.
And giving money to them is haram as
yes.
As homes because people
yes.
had asked them.
Sure.
So they make it in front of the door of Imam's room with the camera. This is how far they are able to get.
Mm.
And Shahid Mutari happens to be there. And he says, what? You want to take this camera? No, Imam doesn't want you to take a picture. They're like, no, no, no. And you know the whole Iranian Eastern kind of taught
yeah,
off.
Yeah.
And no, halal, okay, so it doesn't matter. So let us take it in, blah, blah. You know what Shahid Mutari does? He takes the camera and he smashes it.
Fantastic.
Right there.
Mm.
He says, I will not let you take a picture with Imam. See? another, you know, this is what you do for truth.
Truth.
They are trying to, you see, this is the way munafiq,
yeah,
and people who are hypocrites and people who don't really believe the truth but have to live with the fact that there are,
yeah,
people who actually stand up for truth, and that they can't just openly, they try to do it through, you know, indirect and sneaky ways.
The sneaky ways.
And then a person like Imam Ali alayhi salam, a person like Imam Khomeini, a person like Shahid Muqtadi, when they stand up to them and actually break the camera, which is the tool for them to want to do their nifaq and want to do their, you know, propaganda, well, obviously they're going to cause enemies. And what do? They kill him.
Yes.
And what a great shahadat that is.
Yes.
To be killed by the enemies of truth.
Exactly.
Right? So, the first person they kill is Shahid Muqtadi, and you have the funeral for Shahid Muqtadi. This is 2 months after the revolution. I'm talking about the personality of Imam.
Yes.
Remember, didn't cry when his son was killed in Najaf.
No.
Everybody who was there in Najaf said Imam did not cry at the at the ceremonies for his son.
Sorry.
Didn't cry when he arrived. Didn't cry at the... Nothing.
Nothing.
How do you feel? Nothing.
Heech.
He's crying at Shahid Muqtadi's funeral.
That's right.
Okay?
Yes, I remember.
The only person funeral that he cried at was Shahid Muqtadi's.
Yes.
Yes? Why would he do that? Because he is a person who is embodiment of this polarization. He's the one that wrote the book about the polarization
of Imam Ali.
Right?
Yes.
I'm not saying this is the only reason. I'm saying Imam knows who Shahid Muqtadi is.
Yes. That's why he
Imam knows. You know, who's been martyred.
Martyr.
He's crying on the one hand because he's happy for him that he's martyred.
Martyred.
And that he got to his goal.
Goal.
Right? And on the other hand, he's just thinking about, you know, this humanity. How, these are the people they kill. The way they kill our Mullah. The way they kill all the good ones.
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
So, Imam is crying at Shahid Muqtadi's funeral.
Mm.
And the only other time he cried... that we saw him cry was during Ashura and during Muharram.
That's right.
The ceremonies.
Yes.
Okay, we didn't see him cry anymore.
No.
And what does he say at Shahid Muqtadi's funeral? This is important.
He said, "This is my son."
Besides those things.
Yes.
You know what he said? He says, "Killing us is not going to stop the revolution."
Ah, yes. Excellent.
This revolution is dependent on nobody.
Nobody.
Even if I am killed...
Yes, even if I'm killed.
Even if I'm killed, the revolution
will
continue.
The revolution.
And just a note for those gentlemen for who all these years insist that if they are not around, then the revolution will stray.
No, that's not the case.
Yes. Imam said, even if I'm not there,
there.
The revolution will continue.
Continue.
Because it's not about
personalities.
It's about Islam. It's about Haq.
Haq.
It's about people standing up for Haq, which the people have.
Yes.
Okay?
And there's always somebody else in the wings.
So, they're thinking, oh, we got one of the main dudes.
Yeah.
Then they go kill the 72.
The usual,
you know,
insane type thing.
They kill Shahid Beheshti and the 72 members of the Islamic Republican Party.
Party, yes.
Which is considered the elites and the top management of the revolution.
And the masterminds of the revolution.
Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And thinking, well, that's it.
That's it.
It's
we've
all
done it.
Well, it's not.
No. They didn't do anything.
That's it. Nothing. Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
So, the point is... So we have all this stuff going on. Mm-hmm. We've got the war then going on, and he being a decisive commander.
Sure.
He's saying, for example, he's saying this city has to be liberated.
Mm.
Right?
Yes.
This city, that city, this battle. And then Khorramshahr, which was the main city that the Iraqis had held for years, is liberated.
Yes.
Through the, you know, this ongoing struggle. The... revolutionary forces, the Islamic forces, the Islamic Republican forces are able to, the Iranian forces are able to liberate Khorramshahr. And what does Imam say?
God liberated.
God liberated Khorramshahr. Right?
It's a totally different world.
Right?
Yeah.
Doesn't mean that people didn't struggle.
No, no.
Doesn't mean that he's not...
But the victory is attributed to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Victory and defeat and everything is in God's hands.
Hands.
If you won, don't get arrogant.
Don't get arrogant.
If you won the victory, don't get arrogant.
This is a blessing from Allah.
When they were using chemical weapons, he forbade the use of chemical weapons against the Iraqis.
Yes.
People were saying, well, what does that mean? And, you know, we can respond in kind in Islam, and it's not a problem. And then he's like, nope.
No.
We will not use chemical. This nation which is under the banner of Islam, will not use chemical weapons against other Muslims.
Because this is principle, this is truth.
Right.
Yeah. And the other thing that you were mentioning before we came on air was the fact that, you know, the Imam gave this very powerful command to sink an American ship.
Well, when the Americans entered the Persian Gulf, under the guise of protecting, you know,
the
shipping lanes,
oil tankers, yeah.
The first thing he said is, you know, sink one of them.
Sink one of them.
And, well, they didn't for various reasons.
Yes.
And the justification for not doing it was, well, the Americans are going to enter the war.
Yeah. But they entered it anyway.
And then they entered it anyways.
Yeah.
So
if they had listened to the Imam.
So if they just listened to the Imam.
They wouldn't have entered the war.
I'm not saying the Americans wouldn't have entered it, but, well, if they're going to enter it anyways, you might as well, you know, give them a little warning, a little deterrence, as they say.
A little deterrence.
You know, a little you know, thought along the way, if you want to get involved, things are going to happen.
Mm.
And so this is the deal. When you have a hardcore person like Imam, who's not scared, you see, it has to go back. It goes back to being not scared. How is it that you're not scared? Again, for me, this is theoretical because I'm scared all the time.
Okay.
So what I'm saying, it's not that I'm not claiming that I have this mastered in some way.
Mm.
Why is Imam not scared? And remember his famous quote. He swears by, you know, the unity and oneness of Allah, that I have never been scared of anyone except for Allah. Remember, this is a big.
No, this is big. This is very important.
It's big.
That's just like our imams.
Right, it's big.
It's big.
It's not a small statement.
No.
Okay?
No.
And why isn't he scared? It's because he has complete trust in Allah.
Of course.
I mean,
Allah will do things.
It sounds simple.
Which is beyond human imagination.
No, it sounds simple, right?
Yes, it does. But it's deep. Things happen, which we can't imagine.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, what would have been the consequences if you'd actually sunk an American ship?
Well, I would argue minimum is the Americans would think twice.
Think twice, yes. Or would have let the Soviets deal with the problem.
Well, all I'm saying is that, you know, your action has an effect on things.
Of course they do.
Okay? So, let's say they had done that.
Yeah.
Maybe, I'm not saying, you know, things would have been greatly different.
Sure.
It's the principle of it.
Mm.
If you're going to enter our territory, if you're going to enter our area...
Yeah.
You know, you're going to have to pay for it.
You're going to have to pay for it.
Right? If you want to, go ahead, but you're going to have to pay for it.
Exactly.
Okay? So this is the deal. Mm. This is what a real... You see, we have this thing in the West where it's defense is a necessary evil.
Yeah.
This is the way they justify it in the West.
Yes, that's right.
Especially in the Christian traditions.
Yes.
They say it's a defending yourself militarily is not evil. No. It's good.
It's good.
It's not a necessary evil.
No.
It's good. It's just.
That's what you have to do. Naturally,
it's just. It's the embodiment of justice. It's the embodiment of righteousness.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not a necessary evil to defend yourself.
Sure.
Yes, going to war, getting killed, killing, you know, maiming.
Yeah.
These are not pleasant things to do.
Sure.
And I don't mean pleasant in the... If you're fighting, you know, against shaitan, it's actually quite pleasant.
It is.
Okay? It's not a... You know what I mean?
It's not a part-time hobby.
It's pleasant in the sense that you're doing a righteous act. It's like, you know, you're doing something good.
Yes.
So it shouldn't cause you trouble. And by the way, can I just add something? This came to my mind right now.
Please.
Notice that how in Iran, we don't have the psychological problems among people who go to war as you have in all other countries.
Yes, that's a very good point. I mean,
soldiers don't commit suicide.
Suicide when they come back.
I'm not saying people aren't shell-shocked, some of them.
No, of course they do.
This
suffer.
Is a natural physical reaction to some of
the
things.
The traumas
but we
of
don't
war.
Have that... thing of, you know, veterans returning and becoming, you know, heroin addicts.
Yes,
we don't
psychopaths.
Have, you know, the more amount of people, you know, Vietnam veterans killing themselves from suicide than actually died in Vietnam. You know, we don't have that stuff.
No.
Why? Because in our view, which is the view of Islam, which is the Islam of Ahlul Bayt, going to war is not a bad thing.
It's a good thing.
Especially if it's defending.
Yeah.
Of course, we have to also mention as the main point, which is that all these wars that the West is doing is, you know, unjust offensive attacks against innocent people.
Exactly.
So obviously the soldiers are going to get confused and want to kill themselves after they've killed innocent people.
Exactly.
Okay?
That's
human beings.
That's the consequences of killing innocent
the
people.
Whole, you see, it's crazy. The whole military structure in the West tries to somehow create soldiers that will be immune to the effects of killing innocent people.
Yes.
This is the craziness they've reached.
Yes. But it doesn't work.
It doesn't work. You're dealing with human beings. There's a... You know, you can't change human nature.
No, you can't.
Human nature, however you are, wherever you come from, whether it's Alabama or, you know, whether it's Iran or wherever, you know, human nature is repulsed by killing innocent human other human beings.
It is.
But it is not repulsed by defending against an unjust attack.
Exactly.
It considers it honorable. It considers it dignified. It considers it to be heroic.
Sure.
It considers dying on that way to be heroic. That's why you see that in Britain, because, you know, we like to complain about Britain.
Yeah, we
but
do.
When the British were defending themselves against the Germans' attack.
That's right. They called it their finest hour.
Because it was their finest hour. Because Germans were attacking them, you know, unjustified, you know, in the context of these people fighting each other,
sure.
You know. And so people stood up, and Churchill came and said, we will, you know, what was that?
We'll fight them on the beaches. We'll fight them on the fields.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This is your natural right as a human being to defend yourself.
Absolutely.
If you're being attacked by another nation.
Sure.
Unjustly.
That's right.
So we get it. Mm. The West gets defense. Mm. Okay?
Yeah.
But we don't have these problems in Iran with our soldiers and the people who went to the war. And we don't have the problems of the soldiers integrating back into society. And we don't have the problems of the families and the widows and the orphans that are that are left over. This is a natural part of human life. When you get attacked, you defend, and those who did it are the greatest heroes.
And the other thing that has to be mentioned,
and this is the path. This is the path of the imams, and this is something that a leader like Imam Khomeini understands.
Yes.
And that's why he said that famous sentence. Again, we're going back to this great, immense, intense personality.
Mm.
He says, the war is a great blessing.
Exactly. Because the other great blessing out of that is also martyrdom. Because martyrdom is a great victory, isn't it?
Listen. Mm. People can't wrap their heads around this. Mm. I'm talking about religious people.
Sure.
I'm talking about people who are, you know, in favor of the revolution.
Sure.
Imam says, because we're so indoctrinated by this Western thinking of war as a necessary evil.
Mm-hmm.
And then Imam says, it's a great blessing. The war is a great blessing.
Blessing.
The doors of heaven are opened up, go.
Mm.
And they went.
They went, yes.
And they went. And we're still here.
I know, pity.
Right?
Yeah.
Do you understand?
Yes.
And people who weren't there at that time, they don't understand.
No. They don't know what that meant.
Right.
Yeah, I think basically we're at the end of this particular session in terms of what we were discussing in polarization, you know, with the theme during the war. But of course, you know, this is something that even carries on beyond that.
Right.
And it is, there's no doubt, there is, it's an emotional topic, because really, I mean, when we stand up for truth and we really go according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt and understand the teachings of the Quran. And of course, you know, when God says that, you know, if you fight for Allah's cause, you die for Allah's cause, then death is not applicable in this situation. You're living.
You're not. The martyrs are not dead.
They're not dead.
They live and they're sustained by their God.
They're sustained by their God. And that's what Imam Khomeini re-inculcated back into the Muslim Ummah. This idea that it's not only a great thing to defend your country and to defend your values and to defend your principles, but even if you're killed along the way,
you're a martyr.
You're a martyr. You're somebody of great status.
Right. Your status, your existential state is, you know, raised to that. And it has to do with the fact that you are showing and manifesting your complete obedience and submission to the will of God.
God.
Okay, and it's not that kind of browbeating submission, because people have this idea, and in the West we have this image of God as this kind of browbeating.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
it's ridiculous.
The submission is love.
Love.
It's becoming one with your God.
God.
It's, you know, letting go of yourself.
Exactly.
It's entering that paradise which is God Himself.
Exactly.
Do you understand?
Exactly.
God Himself. You know, paradise is God Himself. It's you know, being in the present. There are different stages of paradise.
Of course.
I'm not
of course.
Technically speaking.
Yes.
But what it is really what we're talking about is God Himself.
God Himself.
And when you feel that love, and you know, that's the highest level, because you know this is the goal. You're trying to feel that connection with Allah, the love, and that's what we talk about submission. We're not talking about submission as a slave submitting you know, deep south of the, you know, antebellum, you know.
No, we're not talking about that.
You know, it's not that submission. It's a
pure
complete
love.
Yeah, it's a complete letting go of yourself.
Exactly.
And complete trust and giving it over to Allah.
Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, on that note, thank you very much indeed for your contribution on The Man Who Changed the World. And it just leaves me to thank our listeners and to say, Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening. and goodbye.
The Light.
Did you know that animals might have the potential to help tackle climate change? Strange indeed, but that seems to be the case according to scientists. The sheep on a remote Scottish island have a special diet that consists mainly of seaweed. This feature is what scientists are hoping can help reduce global warming. Sheep usually feed on grass, and the process contributes to methane emissions. But scientists say the sheep in Orkneys are unique because of spending the winter eating only the marine plants. Listen to one researcher explaining whether fitting seaweed into the sheep diet can actually help reduce gas emissions.
The main thing at the moment is we need to absolutely prove, one, which seaweed is going to be the best for this, what amount of seaweed into the feed gives the best effect, and then can you scale that up to a level where you would actually have an effect on the overall UK farming.
If proven, the Scottish sheep and their unique diet could lead to a breakthrough in methods for livestock breeding, which is a major source of greenhouse gases. Methane is about 30 times more powerful than carbon dioxide in trapping heat in the atmosphere. Meet Clarion, a homemade polar bear whose mission is to raise awareness of climate change in a 500-kilometer pilgrimage to Glasgow. The 3-meter polar bear is work of British furniture maker Bamber Hoss. The bear weighs 17 kilograms and is made of bamboo, willow, and tissue paper. Hoss started his journey with Clarion from his hometown of Bishop's Castle in England to Glasgow. They accomplished their spectacular journey ahead of the United Nations COP26 climate conference in the Scottish city. Hoss says Clarion is a symbol of melting Arctic ice caps due to global warming.
He's called Clarion. Clarion the bear is not a bear. He is a metaphor. He's a symbol. It is a very obvious symbol that a polar bear represents the Arctic, not the Antarctic, and that is where, you know, some of the problems are with melting ice caps. Not all the problems, because they're elsewhere as well.
Hoss says his aim is to encourage people to pay attention to climate change. Environmental activists from across the UK and elsewhere on the continent have also embarked on a long journey on foot to reach the UN Climate Change Conference in Glasgow.
Flocks of sheep are on the streets of Madrid. The animals have made their way through the center of the Spanish capital to follow ancient migration routes. Shepherds accompanied their sheep and goats moving through the streets of the Spanish capital. They actually marked a centuries-old annual tradition that began in 1994. The event allows shepherds to migrate their cattle from summer to winter pastures. They do so based on a deal struck in 1418 that allows the animals to walk through the city freely. The event attracts hundreds of people. It was canceled last year due to the pandemic, but this year, many locals came out to watch.
The Philippines is among the countries facing a soaring plastic waste crisis. However, a group of recyclers are working hard to tackle the problem, turning the waste into building materials. The group is called the Plastic Flamingo, or simply the PLAF. They gather bottles, single-use sachets, and snack food wrappers. The waste is then shredded and molded into post-add planks that can be used for decking and fencing. Their products are also durable enough to make disaster relief shelters and urban furniture. The group says the coronavirus pandemic has worsened the plastic waste problem, sparking a rush for protection equipment. Their disposal is a matter of concern now.
Because of the plastic problem we're currently facing, the pandemic, the huge accumulation of plastic use, there's also improper disposal. People are unaware on, you know, how do I dispose these plastics? Where do I dispose of them? So at the same time, we give that avenue also that instead of putting it in landfills or oceans in general, you know, you give it to the PLAF, you give it to recycling centers like us, and we would recycle these, upcycle them into better products.
The PLAF says surging online shopping is also another problem that they try to address. The group has collected over 100 tons of plastic waste since it started the business in 2019. However, they still have a lot to do. A UN report says some 300 million tons of plastic waste are produced annually, with South Asian countries accounting for 60% of it. A North Macedonian zoo has a new inhabitant. It may be small, but it has certainly sparked a big amount of joy. The baby marmoset was born 3 weeks ago. Its parents are super protective of their precious offspring. That's why zoo staff have not been able to get close to the baby and determine if it's a male or a female. The tiny primate will be given a name after its sex is known. Marmosets are the world's smallest monkeys. On average, they are about 13 centimeters long and weigh up to 100 grams. The adorable animals can be found in a number of countries in the Americas.
The hustle and bustle of modern life has made it difficult to communicate with nature the way humans used to do a few decades ago. Now a giant statue in the state of New York reminds us of the importance of lending an attentive ear to our surroundings. The massive statue, named Water's Soul, is located along the Hudson River. Her woman's head, with her index finger pressing on her lips, seems she's asking bystanders to maintain silence. It's a work of 66-year-old Spanish artist Juanme Palenza. He says the message of his work is, quote, to call on people to listen to the profound noise of the water talking to us. Water's Soul was made of polyester resin, fiberglass, and marble dust at a Barcelona studio. It was later shipped to its Jersey City site for assembly. The sculpture is 24 meters tall.
You might have heard of Iran's stellar wrestling achievements or about its soccer team, but that's not all. Another sport has grabbed attention too. Golfers now competing during Iran's national golf tournament in Tehran. This year, 90 participants from around the country played on a very unique golf course. It has only 13 holes instead of the standard 18, but that hasn't stopped golf enthusiasts playing the 13 holes and then repeating the last five to complete the tournament. The good news is that the golf course might not stay so small for long. Iran's Golf Federation hopes to bring in more people interested in golf. But for this to happen, the infrastructure must be provided first.
We don't have the space to use the 350 instructors to train the 3,000 registered men and women across the country, so we decided to build a national academy off the golf course. Course number 18 will be used in a competition venue during tournaments and as a training and education venue during non-competition times.
When the course was built decades ago in northern Tehran, it had five more holes. But over the years, fairways were laid across parts of the field, reducing playable footprint. Tehran's golf club has about 300 members, half are women. Golf has been around in Iran for over a century, and most of the courses are in southern provinces.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Concerned about endangered animals? If yes, then it will be good news that a Mexican zoo has welcomed a newborn zebra. It belongs to the most threatened of the three species of zebra in the world. The foal made a public appearance Thursday, 10 days after it was born at a zoo in northern Mexico. It's about 50 centimeters tall. Its weight, between 10 to 15 kilograms. The newborn equine raises hopes for the conservation of the imperial zebra species.
We are the only zoo in Mexico that has this species of zebra. Unfortunately, it is an endangered species. Here at the zoo, we are doing everything possible to preserve and produce them so that in the future we can repopulate some other parks.
The imperial zebra is native to Africa. It is the largest of the wild equids, the family of horses, donkeys, and other animals. Currently, there are less than 2,500 of imperial zebras in the wild. That's blamed on the destruction of their habitat, illegal hunting, and lack of food.
The world's largest Ferris wheel has opened to public in the United Arab Emirates. Dubbed the Dubai Eye, the wheel takes the visitors to a height of 250 meters, feasts their eyes on the city skyline. That is almost double the height of the iconic London Eye and over 80 meters taller than the high roller in the U.S. city of Las Vegas. Each full rotation of the giant structure takes 38 minutes. The city put on a spectacular firework and light display to celebrate the open.
The 38th edition of the International Short Film Festival has kicked off in the Iranian capital, with some 63 films from 32 countries competing in the event. The festival has for the first time turned into an Oscar qualifying event, giving winning entries a shot at the Academy Awards. This is being held at Tehran's famous Iran Mall cinema complex, and it will showcase short feature, documentary, and experimental works. Five Iranian films and 58 from abroad are selected for the grand prize, and the winner will be presented to the Academy for possible Oscar nomination. The jury has members from Iran as well as Italy, Japan, and France. The festival will be running until October 23rd.
Natural disasters often disrupt normal life, but that's not the case with an Indian couple who got married despite their town being submerged by floodwaters. The couple, identified by local media as health workers in Kerala State, managed to reach a temple for the wedding in a giant cooking pot. They could be seen smiling and waving in their ceremonial clothes while two of their relatives were steering the pot. The couple reportedly borrowed the pot from the temple, saying that was the only option available. The pair was unwilling to postpone their big day, adding an unforgettable story to a country that is famous for many incredible things. Feeling down? It's all right to cry and get help. That's all what a place called the Crying Room tries to tell its visitors in Spain. The crying room is part of a building located in central Madrid. It's free and open to the public. The crying room aims to remove the stigma attached to mental health, crying, and seeking help. It offers a wide range of services, from a corner to crying, to a phone with a list of psychologists people can call. Motivating messages are also visible on the walls. People have hailed the initiative, saying it helps them speak out about their negative emotions.
I think it's an excellent idea to visualize the widespread of the mental health issue. And I think it's a really fun take on it, to call it the crying room, because of the Spanish expression, if you want to cry, go to the crying room. So it's kind of stigmatized to cry in Spain, as in many other countries. So I wanted to take part in this this visualization of the problem.
The crying room was opened in an effort to raise awareness about mental health and well-being. Official data in Spain showed that around 40% of people had symptoms of depression last year. Another 30% experienced anxiety.
The first movie in orbit in the making. Two Russian nationals who travel to the International Space Station to shoot scenes of that movie are now back on Earth. The Soyuz MS-18 spacecraft carrying an actress and a film director undocked from the ISS early Sunday and successfully touched down in Kazakhstan about 3 hours later. The film crew, along with a veteran astronaut, blasted off from the Russian leased Baikonur Cosmodrome earlier this month. They spent 12 days in the ISS to shoot the scenes. The mission beats a Hollywood movie project starring Tom Cruise. The mission adds to a long list of firsts for Russia's space industry.
Materials and methods are vital for an artist who combines them to create a masterpiece. Well, a Brazilian artist has used an unusual material to create a huge, dazzling artwork. Mondano has drawn a mural measuring 1,000 square meters using ashes from the burned Amazon rainforest. The artwork on the side of a building in the city of Sao Paulo depicts a firefighter standing near the scenes of deforestation, blazes, and dead animals. Mondano says he traveled extensively to feel that sadness and, more importantly, to collect ashes from for his paintings. He says his aim is to call attention to the environment in his home country, where thousands of wildfires break out each year.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic beliefs. I'm your host, Musa Al-Bahali, and joining me is our dear friend, Sayyid Muhsin Naqawi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, welcome and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Our question today is about the theological beliefs of Islam and also the rulings of Islam. Mm-hmm. And in a world where the Western world especially is so focused on these rights and laws, it is refreshing to see that Islam already had such rulings in place. And our question regards one such ruling. Why is it that in Islam, custody of children is given to the father, when almost all of the problems and troubles that are associated with the upbringing of children, such as birthing, breastfeeding, raising, and so on and so forth, are the responsibility of the mother? This is the opposite of what the entire developing world is actually doing, where they give the custody to the woman. So what then is the reasoning behind this in Islam, dear Sayyid?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created us He just not created us for just in vain. There is a purpose behind it.
Right.
There are some responsibilities and tasks that we have in our life which we need to fulfill in order to become the true slaves of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. In the Quran, if I look at I was looking at the verse number 233 of Surah Al-Baqarah, chapter Baqarah, this is second chapter, verse number 233. In that, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَالْوَالِدَاتُ يُرْضِعْنَ أَوْلَادَهُنَّ حَوْلَيْنِ كَامِلَيْنِ, that the mothers should breastfeed their children for 2 years, complete 2 years.
Right.
Okay, this is the first part, and there are some other parts of it, other than that. And after that, it says, وَعَلَى الْمَوْلُودِ, and upon the one who had the child, lehu, for him. Now here, Allah is talking about the father now. First, he talked
right.
about the mother, that mother should breastfeed for two years, the complete 2 years. And after that, وَعَلَى الْمَوْلُودِ, lehu, and for the one who has the child, like the father, رِزْقُهُنَّ وَكِسْبَتُهُنَّ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ,
right.
Allah has put the responsibility of sustenance, bringing food, clothes, everything on the father.
He bears the responsibility
he
of not
has
just
the responsibility,
woman,
yes.
but also the child.
For the child and the woman as well.
Right.
Even if I say, in the divorce, generally, the husband and wife, they are separate
right.
in the divorce. Even in the divorce, if the child is under the custody of the mother, obviously there are the rulings. I will explain about the rulings as well.
Of course.
The father has the responsibility of providing the food and clothes to the son and his mother as well, because she's feeding
right.
the child. So even at that time, he has to bring some kind of sustenance to help out.
Right.
The mother, in order to raise this child,
because she's taking care of his child.
Yes, his child. Now, in the jurisprudence, we see that the custody of child. When we talk about the child, we need to separate the boy and girl.
Right.
We need to separate it.
So there's a
for
difference.
There's a difference. For the boy, he can after the birth. He can stay. He is in the custody of his mother for 2 years,
right?
And after that, he moves to the custody of father. For the girl, she will remain in the custody of mother for 7 years, and after that, she will go towards the father. That's
okay.
the first thing.
It's a big difference then.
Yes, big difference. Now, on the other hand, if we look at the age of bulugh. Becoming adult in the Islamic
right.
terms,
puberty.
We say baligh.
We do not really use the term puberty in this manner.
No. That's why I'm using
right.
the Arabic terminology.
Right.
Baligh.
Right.
That's something else.
Becoming of age in an
yes.
Islamic manner.
In an Islamic manner, becoming adult, legally
right.
they can decide for themselves. So that's why I use the word adult, and then I'm using the word baligh, bulugh.
Right.
When they become baligh or they are bulugh, this is an Arabic term, baligh. It's not the English term, it's an Arabic. For the boy, it is said he becomes baligh at the age of 15.
Right.
For the girl, it is at age of 9. Now, when you look at this age that the boy was with the mother, under the custody of mother for 2 years, and until the age of 15, he's under the custody of father.
Right.
And once he becomes baligh, obviously he's baligh. Now he can decide for himself if he wants. If he is aqil, he is obviously he has all those conditions.
Right.
For the girl, she remains with her mother for 7 years, and after that, for 2 years, she's with the father, because at the age of 9 she becomes baligh.
Right.
So on the other hand, we can see there is a less amount for the father as well. It's both ways. The girl is
right.
For 2 years with the father. And 7 years with the mother. On the other hand, boy, yes, he is 2 years with the mother,
right.
the first 2 years, and then the rest of 13 years with
and
the
father. And that's assuming they don't
father.
Hit
so
balugh or puberty,
yes.
we say in parentheses,
now,
before that.
The problem is when we look at these issues, the rulings in the jurisprudence in Islam, we should not look at the sub-rule. We should look at something as a whole from all aspects. And then you can decide whether it is, according to the justice or not, whether the custody, more custody is with the father or the mother. Okay? So we cannot just decide by looking at one part.
Of course.
First thing is that it is a clear ruling that the boy for first 2 years, and after that the custody goes to the father. First 2 years is with the mother, and then it goes to the father. For the girl, first 7 years, the custody is with the mother, and the rest is with the father until they become baligh. On the other hand, we see that the food, the clothes, all these things are the responsibilities of father. And this is a clear statement of the Quran that وَعَلَى الْمَوْلُودِ لَهُ رِزْقُهُنَّ وَكِسْفَتُهُنَّ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ.
Right.
You know, it is upon the father to bring, not upon the mother. It's not upon the mother. So when everything is the responsibility of father from, you know, the very first day till end, even the mother can claim, can take money for the breastfeed.
Right. You know, she cannot be forced to breastfeed.
Yeah, she cannot be forced. Mm. It is said,
even though it is her own child.
Yes, it is. It is the ruling for his, for her own child. She cannot, you know, forcibly be. So she can claim for some, you know, money or
compensation
for that.
It's basically a job with salary.
Yes, he has to pay, so she can have a good salary at that time.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
We see that the whole responsibility is with the father.
In reality.
Now, why it is said that the boy should remain with the mother for 2 years and the girl for the 7 years?
Some might pose a question here.
Yes, it's because the first 2 years is important for every child.
Right.
Because in the Quran, Allah has said, like, the mother should breastfeed the child for 2 years.
As a natural physical need.
It's natural. It's scientifically, the doctor says, do not give this powder, you know, the milk. Use the mother should breastfeed the...
Breast milk is healthier.
It's healthier. And he or she, like the boy or girl, should be breastfeed for 2 years. So first 2 years. After that, we can see that, obviously, boys should follow the footsteps of father, because he has to go out naturally. He has to be trained as a man so that he can serve the society, the responsibilities that he has. That's why after 2 years he straightforward goes to the custody of the father, whereas girl remains for 7 years with the mother, and last 2 years before becoming baligh goes to the father. Now in those 7 years, the first 7 years, she's getting trained by the mother.
Right.
And those last 2 years is for him so that she's also attached to the father. She does not forget her father.
Of course, when you say training,
that she becomes, yes.
We mean being raised.
Yeah, being raised. When we talk about the training, it's been being raised, looking
after. Accustomed to the manners, etiquette, how should a woman be, how should a male be for that manner.
All these things are obviously including, we include in these... when we talk about the training and being raised up, brought up. So if they are, when we talk about their brought up, being trained, raised up, all these things includes all those factors. Right. And it is obviously, you know, logical, it is right that the boys generally, the fathers are the role models for the boys.
Right. Right.
And for girls, it's their mother, generally. They're the role models. Naturally, it is. So that's what Islam talks about. So therefore, when we talk about the Islamic rulings, rather than saying, like, why Islam has said that the father should have the custody of the children, It's not like that. There are specific rulings. For boys, it's different. For girls, it's different. Right. As a whole, the whole responsibility is on the shoulders of father.
Right.
You know, if the kids remains under the custody of mother, he's paying for the child and the mother. Whereas right. when the child becomes like comes in the custody of the father, then he's just right. looking after the kid. He has not. He is not paying anything extra right. to the one who's been divorced or separated. I don't know. Right. Different ways.
Right.
So logically, when we see logically, intellectually, when we see the whole picture, then we do understand why is this happening, and it is according to the justice.
Right. So they say it, and when we say that the custody goes from the mother to the father for perhaps a boy after he has spent 2 years with the mother. Must the father take him to live with him, for example, or can he choose to let the child stay with his mother?
It's upon the two parties, basically. It's upon okay. the father, because after 2 years, it's the responsibility of father. But if father says or agrees that the child can remain with his mother, that's right. fine.
So if
there's
the child
no, there's no compulsion.
Right.
The compulsion is, yes, there is a ruling. The ruling has been set that right. after 2 years, the custody is with the father.
Right.
But if the father allows child to remain with the mother, and if they agree, both parties, like the mother and father, for specific years, for example, even if they agree, both of them agree, like the child will remain under the custody, the boy remains under the custody of mother for 7 years, for example, 80 right. years, and after that, father will take the custody or responsibility after onwards, that is fine. You know, the doors are open.
Okay.
It's a mutual understanding.
They're flexible.
There is a specific rule. There's right. a basic rule which we need to follow. At least we need to follow this. After that, Islam right. has left the doors open for the mother
Natural.
And father
right.
that if they think this is good for their child, they can decide the same thing.
And just one small question adding on to this. Can the mother then also claim compensation if the child stays with her or...
No, if it is an agreement between them, after the 2 years, there is no responsibility on the father,
okay.
for the boy.
Okay.
And after 7 years for the girl, there is no responsibility for the mother.
Right.
Yes, for the child, there is, obviously, until they
right.
become baligh.
Right. Dear Said, I thank you for your time and
Welcome.
Taking time out of the day to answer these questions. I also thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. Yet again, this had been your host, Musa Al-Bahali, and you had been listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Thank you for tuning in.
إن في الجنة نهر اللبن إن في الجنة نهر اللبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهر اللبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.